own. This is the case, for example, with musical hallucinations, which are imposed upon and not sought by those who have them, and are thus quite different from the musical imagery or imagination one feels to be one's own. On the performance side, this is what happens with musicians' dystonia, when the fingers refuse to obey one's will and curl up or show a will of their own. In such circumstances, a part of the brain is at odds with one's intentionality, oneself. Even if there is no misalignment of a gross sort, where mind and brain are in conflict with one another, musicality, like other gifts, can create its own problems. I think here of the eminent composer Tobias Picker, who also, as it happens, has Tourette's syndrome. Soon after I met him, he told me that he had a congenital disorder that had bullied him all his life. I assumed that he was talking about his Tourette's, but he said no. The congenital disorder was his great musicality. He had, it seemed, been born with this. He had recognized and tapped out tunes in the first years of life, and had started to play the piano and compose at 4. By the age of 7 he could reproduce long and elaborate pieces of music after a single hearing, and constantly found himself overwhelmed by musical emotion. He said that it was understood, practically from the start, that he would be a musician, and that he had little chance of doing anything else, because his musicality was all-consuming. He would not, I think, have had it any other way, but he sometimes felt that his musicality controlled him, rather than the other way around. Many artists and performers no doubt have the same feeling at times, but with music, as with mathematics, such abilities can be especially precocious and may determine one's life from a very early age. Listening to Picker's music, watching him play or compose, I have the feeling that he has a special brain, a musician's brain, very different from my own. It is a brain that works differently and has connections, whole fields of activity that mine lacks. It is difficult to know how much such differences may be congenital, as Picker puts it, and how much they are the result of training. A tricky question, since Picker, like many musicians, began intensive musical training in early childhood. With the development of brain imaging in the 1990s, it became possible to actually visualize the brains of musicians and to compare them with those of non-musicians. Using MRI morphometry, Gottfried Schlaug at Harvard and his colleagues made careful comparisons of the sizes of various brain structures. In 1995, they published a paper showing that the corpus callosum, the great commissure that connects the two hemispheres of the brain, is enlarged in professional musicians, and that a part of the auditory cortex, the planum temporal, has an asymmetric enlargement in musicians with absolute pitch. Schlaug et al. Went on to show increased volumes of gray matter in motor, auditory, and visuospatial areas of the cortex, as well as in the cerebellum. Anatomists today would be hard put to identify the brain of a visual artist, a writer, or a mathematician, but they could recognize the brain of a professional musician without a moment's hesitation. How much, Schlaug wondered, are these differences a reflection of innate predisposition, and how much an effect of early musical training? One does not, of course, know what distinguishes the brains of musically gifted 4-year-olds before they start musical training, but the effects of such training, Schlaug and his colleagues showed, are very great. The anatomical changes they observed with musicians' brains were strongly correlated with the age at which musical training began, and with the intensity of practice and rehearsal. Alvaro Pascual León at Harvard has shown how rapidly the brain responds to musical training. Using 5-finger piano exercises as a training test, he has demonstrated that the motor cortex can show changes within minutes of practicing such sequences. Measurements of regional blood flow in different parts of the brain, moreover, have shown increased activity in the basal ganglia and the cerebellum, as well as various areas of the cerebral cortex, not only with physical practice, but with mental practice alone. There is clearly a wide range of musical talent, but there is much to suggest there is an innate musicality in virtually everyone. This has been shown most clearly by the use of the Suzuki method to train young children, entirely by ear and by imitation, to play the violin. Virtually all hearing children respond to such training. Even profoundly deaf people may have innate musicality. Deaf people often love music and are very responsive to rhythm, which they feel as vibration, not as sound. The acclaimed percussionist, Evelyn Glennie, has been profoundly deaf since the age of 12. It has been said that even a brief exposure to classical music can stimulate or enhance mathematical, verbal, and visuospatial abilities in children, the so-called Mozart effect. This has been disputed by Schellenberg and others, but what is beyond dispute is the effect of intensive early musical training on the young plastic brain. Takako Fujioka and her colleagues, using magnetoencephalography to examine auditory evoked potentials in the brain, have recorded striking changes in the left hemisphere of children who have had only a single year of violin training compared to children with no training. Can musical competence be seen as a universal human potential in the same way as linguistic competence? There is exposure to language in every household, and virtually all children develop linguistic competence, in a Chomskyan sense, by the age of 4 or 5. This may not be the case with regard to music, since some households may be almost devoid of music, and musical potential, like other potentials, needs stimulation to develop fully. In the absence of encouragement or stimulation, musical talents may not develop. But while there is a fairly well-defined critical period for language acquisition in the first years of life, this is less so for music. To be languageless at the age of 6 or 7 is a catastrophe. It is only likely to occur in the case of deaf children, given no effective access to either sign or speech. But to be musicless at the same age does not necessarily predict a musicless future. My friend, Jerry Marks, grew up with very little exposure to music. His parents never went to concerts and rarely listened to music on the radio. There were no instruments or books on music in the house. Jerry was puzzled when classmates talked about music, and he wondered why they were so interested in it. "I had a tin ear," he recalled. "I could not sing a tune, I could not tell if others sang in tune, and I could not distinguish one note from another." A precocious child, Jerry was passionate about astronomy, and he seemed all set for a life of science, without music. But when he was 14, he became fascinated by acoustics, especially the physics of vibrating strings. He read about this and did experiments in the school lab, but increasingly craved a stringed instrument for himself. His parents gave him a guitar for his 15th birthday, and he soon taught himself to play. The sounds of the guitar and the feeling of plucked strings excited him, and he learned rapidly. By the time he was 17, he came in 3rd in a contest for the most musical in his senior class in high school. His high school friend, Stephen J. Gould, musical from infancy, came in 2nd. Jerry went on to major in music at college, where he supported himself by teaching guitar and banjo. A passion for music has been central to his life ever since. Nevertheless, there are limits imposed by nature. Having absolute pitch, for example, is highly dependent on early musical training, but such training cannot, by itself, guarantee absolute pitch. Nor, as Cordelia shows, can the presence of absolute pitch guarantee that there will be other, higher musical gifts. Cordelia's planum temporale was no doubt well developed, but perhaps she was a bit lacking in prefrontal cortex, in judgment. George, on the other hand, while doubtless well endowed in those areas of the brain involved in emotional reaction to music, may have been lacking in other areas. The examples of George and Cordelia introduce a theme that will be echoed and explored in many of the clinical case histories that follow, that what one calls musicality comprises a great range of skills and receptivities, from the most elementary perceptions of pitch and tempo to the highest aspects of musical intelligence and sensibility, and that, in principle, all of these are dissociable one from another. All of us, indeed, are stronger in some aspects of musicality, weaker in others, and so have some kinship to both Cordelia and George. Chapter 8. Things Fall Apart. Amusia and Disharmonia. We take our senses for granted. We feel we are given the visual world, for example, complete with depth, color, movement, form, and meaning all perfectly matched and synchronous. Given this seeming unity, it may not occur to us that there are many different elements composing a single visual scene, and that all of these have to be separately analyzed and then put together. This composite nature of visual perception may be more apparent to an artist or a photographer, or it may become apparent when, due to some damage or failure of development, one element or another is defective or lost. The perception of color has its own neural basis, and so, too, have the perception of depth, motion, form, and so on. But even if all of these preliminary perceptions are working, there may be difficulty synthesizing them into a visual scene or object with meaning. Someone with such a higher-order defect here, a visual agnosia, for example, may be able to copy a picture or paint a scene so that others can recognize it, but they themselves cannot. It is similar with hearing and with the special complexities of music. There are many elements involved, all concerned with the perception, decoding and synthesis of sound and time, and thus there are many forms of amusia. A.L. Benton, in his chapter on the amusias in Critchley and Henson's Music and the Brain, distinguishes receptive from interpretive or performance amusia, and identifies more than a dozen varieties. There are forms of rhythm deafness, slight or profound, congenital or acquired. Che Guevara was famously rhythm deaf. He might be seen dancing a mambo while the orchestra was playing a tango. He also had considerable tone deafness. But, especially after a left hemisphere stroke, one can develop profound forms of rhythm deafness without tone deafness, just as, after some right hemisphere strokes, a patient may develop tone deafness without rhythm deafness. In general, though, forms of rhythm deafness are rarely total, because rhythm is represented widely in the brain. There are also cultural forms of rhythm deafness. Thus, as Erin Hannon and Sandra Trehub have reported, infants at 6 months can readily detect all rhythmic variations, but by 12 months their range has narrowed, albeit sharpened. They can now more easily detect the types of rhythms to which they have previously been exposed. They learn and internalize a set of rhythms for their culture. Adults find it harder still to perceive foreign rhythmic distinctions. Having been raised on Western classical music, I have no difficulty with its relatively simple rhythms and time signatures, but I get confused by the more complex rhythms of tangos or mambos, to say nothing of the syncopations and polyrhythms of jazz or African music. Culture and exposure determine some of one's tonal sensitivities as well. Thus, someone like myself may find the diatonic scale more natural and more orienting than the 22-note scales of Hindu music. But there does not seem to be any innate neurological preference for particular types of music, any more than there are for particular languages. The only indispensable elements of music are discrete tones and rhythmic organization. Many of us are unable to sing or whistle in tune, though usually we are very conscious of this. We do not have an amusia. But true tone deafness is present in perhaps 5% of the population, and people with such an amusia can veer off-key without realizing it, or be unable to recognize off-key singing by others. Sometimes tone deafness can be quite gross. I used to attend a small temple that employed a cantor who could hit jarringly wrong notes, sometimes a third of an octave away from where he should have been. He particularly fancied himself a cantillator, and would embark on elaborate tonal excursions of a sort that require a very good ear, but he would get completely lost in these. When I complained discreetly to the rabbi one day about the cantor's singing, I was told that he was a man of exemplary piety, and that he did his best. I said I had no doubt of this, but that one could not have a tone-deaf cantor. This was, to anyone musical, akin to having a clumsy surgeon. Florence Foster Jenkins, a coloratura who attracted a sell-out audience to Carnegie Hall in her time, considered herself a great singer and attempted the most difficult operatic arias, arias that required a flawless ear as well as an extraordinary vocal range. But she would sing notes that were excruciatingly wrong, flat, even screechy, without, apparently, realizing that she was doing so. Her sense of rhythm was also terrible, but audiences continued to flock to her concerts, which always featured great theatrics and many costume changes. Whether her fans were devoted to her in spite of her lack of musicality or because of it is not clear. Those with gross tone deafness can still enjoy music and enjoy singing. Amusia, in its absolute sense, total amusia, is another matter, for here tones are not recognized as tones, and music, therefore, is not experienced as music. Some of the classic cases in the neurological literature describe this. Henri Ekéan and Martin L. Albert noted that for such people, melodies lose their musical quality and may acquire a non-musical, disagreeable character. They described one man, a former singer, who complained of hearing a screeching car whenever he heard music. I found these descriptions almost unimaginable until I experienced amusia myself on two occasions, both in 1974. On the first, I was driving along the Bronx River Parkway, listening to a Chopin ballade on the radio, when a strange alteration of the music occurred. The beautiful piano tones started to lose their pitch and their character, and were reduced within a couple of minutes to a sort of toneless banging with an unpleasant metallic reverberation, as if the ballade were being played with a hammer on sheet metal. Though I had lost all sense of melody, I had no impairment of rhythmic sense, and I could still recognize the ballade by its rhythmic structure. A few minutes later, just as the piece was ending, normal tonality returned. Greatly puzzled by all this, when I got home, I phoned the radio station and asked them if this had been some sort of experiment or joke. They said no, of course not, and suggested that I get my radio checked. A few weeks later, I had a similar episode while playing a Chopin mazurka on my piano. There was again a profound loss of tone, and the music seemed to decompose into a disconcerting racket, along with an unpleasant metallic reverberation. But this time it was accompanied by a brilliant, scintillating zigzag expanding in half of my visual field. I had often experienced such zigzags during attacks of migraine. Now, it was evident, I was experiencing an amusia as part of a migraine aura. Still, when I went downstairs and spoke to my landlord, I found that my voice and his voice sounded perfectly normal. It was only music and not speech or sound in general that was so strangely affected. My experience, like most of those described in the neurological literature, was of an acquired amusia, one that I found startling and frightening, but also fascinating. Were there, I wondered, people with congenital amusia of an equally extreme degree? I was startled to find the following passage in Nabokov's autobiography, Speak, Memory. Music, I regret to say, affects me merely as an arbitrary succession of more or less irritating sounds. The concert piano and all wind instruments bore me in small doses and flay me in larger ones. I do not know what to make of this, for Nabokov is such a jester, such an ironist, that one is never sure whether to take him seriously. But it is conceivable, at least, that in the Pandora's box of his multitudinous gifts there was, along with these, perhaps, a profound amusia. I had met the French neurologist François Lhermitte, who once told me that when he heard music, he could say only that it was the Marseillaise, or that it was not. His ability to recognize melodies stopped there. He did not seem distressed by this, nor had he ever had the impulse to investigate its neural basis. It was simply the way he was, and had always been. I should have asked him how he recognized the Marseillaise. Was it by its rhythm or the sound of a particular instrument? By the behavior or attention of other people around him? And what did it actually sound like to him? I wondered when and how he had discovered his amusia, and what effect, if any, it had on his life. But we had only a few minutes together, and conversation veered to other topics. I would not meet another person with complete congenital amusia for another 20 years, and only then through the kindness of my colleague Isabel Peretz, a pioneer in the study of neuroscience and music. In late 2006, Peretz introduced me to D.L., an intelligent, young-looking, 76-year-old woman who has never heard music, though she seems to hear, recognize, remember, and enjoy other sounds and speech without difficulty. Mrs. L. recollected that when she was in kindergarten, children were asked to sing their names, as in, "My name is Mary Adams." She could not do this, and did not know what was meant by singing, nor could she perceive what the other children were doing. In second or third grade, she said, there was a music appreciation class in which 5 pieces, including the William Tell Overture, were played. "I could never tell which piece was being played," she said. When her father heard of this, he got a Victrola and records of the 5 pieces. "He played them again and again," she said, but it didn't help. He also got her a little toy piano or xylophone that could be played by numbers, and she learned in this way to play Mary Had a Little Lamb and Frère Jacques, while having no sense that she was producing anything but noise. If others played these songs, she could not tell whether they made mistakes, but if she herself made a mistake, she would feel this, she said, "in my fingers, not by hearing." She came from a very musical family. Everyone played an instrument, and her mother would always ask her, "Why don't you like music the way the other girls do?" A family friend who was a learning specialist tested her with pitches. DL was asked to stand up if a note was higher than another, or to sit down if it was lower. But this, too, failed. "I could not tell if one note was higher than the other," she said. DL was told as a little girl that her voice was monotonous when she recited poetry, and one teacher set herself to tutor her in inflections and intonations, to read dramatically. This apparently was successful, for I could not detect anything abnormal in her speech. Indeed, she now spoke warmly of Byron and Sir Walter Scott, and when I asked her to, she recited The Lay of the Last Minstrel with expression and feeling. She enjoyed poetry readings and going to the theatre. She had no difficulty recognizing people's voices, nor did she have difficulty recognizing all sorts of sounds around her. Water running, wind blowing, cars hooting, dogs barking. D.L. loved tap dancing as a girl, was very good at it, and could tap dance on skates. She said she was a street kid, and liked to perform with other kids on the street. She seemed, therefore, to have a good sense of rhythm in her body, and now likes rhythmic aerobics. But if there was a musical accompaniment, this would throw her off and interfere with her dancing. When I tapped a simple rhythm with my pencil, like the opening of Beethoven's 5th or a bit of Morse code, Mrs. L. could easily imitate it. But if the rhythm was embedded in a complex melody, she had much more trouble, and the rhythm tended to be lost in the overall noisy confusion she heard. During junior high school, D.L. developed a liking for war songs. This was in the mid-1940s. "I recognized them because of their words," she said. "Anything with words is okay." Her father, newly encouraged, bought records of war songs. But, she remembered, if an orchestra was in the background, it drove me crazy, like sounds coming from all different directions, overwhelming noise. People often ask Mrs. L what she hears when music is played, and she answers, "If you were in my kitchen and threw all the pots and pans on the floor, that's what I hear." Later, she said that she was very sensitive to high notes, and that if she went to an opera, it all sounded like screaming. "I couldn't recognize the Star-Spangled Banner," Mrs. L said. "I had to wait until others stood up." She also failed to recognize "Happy Birthday to You," even though when she became a teacher, she would play a recording of it at least 30 times a year when any of my students had a birthday. When she was in college, a professor did some hearing tests on all of his students and told D.L. that she had impossible results. He wondered if she could, in fact, perceive music. Around this time, she started going out with boyfriends. "I went to all these musicals," she told me, "including Oklahoma. My father managed to cough up enough for a 90-cent seat." She would sit through these musicals. They were not too bad, she said, if only one person was singing, as long as it was not too high. She mentioned that when her mother had a stroke and was admitted to a nursing home, all sorts of activities, but especially music, delighted and calmed her. But Mrs. L said that if she were in the same position, music would make her worse, drive her mad. 7 or 8 years ago, Mrs. L saw an article in the New York Times about Isabel Peretz's work on amusia, and she said to her husband, "That's what I have." Although she had never thought of her problem as psychological or emotional, as her mother seemed to, she had not explicitly thought of it as neurological. Excitedly, she wrote to Peretz, and in her subsequent meeting with Peretz and Krista Hyde, she was reassured that the condition was real, not in her mind, and that others had it as well. She got in touch with other amusic people, and feels that now, with a bona fide condition, she can excuse herself from going to musical events. She wishes that a diagnosis of amusia had been made when she was 7 rather than 70. This might have saved her from a lifetime of being bored or excruciated by concerts to which she went only out of politeness. In 2002, Ayotte, Peretz and Hyde published a paper, "Congenital Amusia, a group study of adults afflicted with a music-specific disorder," in the journal Brain, based on their investigation of 11 subjects. Most of them had normal perception of speech and environmental sounds, but the majority were profoundly impaired in recognizing melodies and in pitch discrimination, unable to distinguish between adjacent tones and semitones. Without these basic building blocks, there can be no sense of a tonal center or key, no sense of scale or melody or harmony, any more than, in a spoken language, one can have words without syllables. When Mrs. L compared the sound of music to that of pots and pans being thrown around the kitchen, I was puzzled, for it seemed to me that pitch discrimination alone, however defective, would not produce such an experience. It was as if the whole character, the timbre of musical notes, was being radically undermined. Timbre is the particular quality or acoustic richness of a sound produced by an instrument or a voice, independent of its pitch or loudness. It is what distinguishes a middle C played on a piano from the same note played on a saxophone. The timbre of a sound is influenced by all sorts of factors, including the frequencies of harmonics or overtones, and the onset, rise, and decay of acoustic waveforms. The ability to maintain a sense of timbre constancy is a multi-leveled and extremely complex process in the auditory brain that may have some analogies with colour constancy. Indeed, the language of colour is often applied to timbre, which is sometimes referred to as sound colour or tone colour. I had a similar impression reading Hekeyan and Albert's case history of the man for whom music was transformed into the sound of a screeching car, and with my own experience of a Chopin ballade sounding as if it were being banged out on a sheet of steel. And Robert Silvers has written to me of how Joseph Alsop, the journalist, used to tell me that the music I admired, or indeed any music, for him was something like the sound of a horse-drawn carriage passing over cobbled streets. These cases, like D.L.'s, differed somewhat from the cases of pure pitch amusia, described by Ayotte et al. In 2002. The term dysdambria is beginning to be used to denote such experiences, and to be recognized as a distinct form of amusia that may coexist with defective pitch discrimination, or occur on its own. Timothy Griffiths, A.R. Jennings, and Jason Warren recently reported the striking case of a 42-year-old man who, after suffering a right hemisphere stroke, experienced dysdambria without any alteration of pitch perception. Mrs. L., it would seem, has both congenital dysdambria and impairments of pitch perception. One might think, too, that a gross dysdambria for musical notes would make speech sound very different, and perhaps unintelligible. But this was not the case with Mrs. L. Indeed, Balan, Zatori, and their colleagues have found voice-selective areas in the auditory cortex that are anatomically separate from the areas involved in the perception of musical timbre. I asked Mrs. L. how she felt about her failure to get music. Was she ever curious or wistful about what others were feeling? She replied that she had been curious as a child. If I had a wish, it would be to hear music as others heard it. But she no longer gives this much thought. She cannot perceive or imagine what others are enjoying so much, but she has many other interests and does not think of herself as defective or as missing an essential part of life. She is simply the way she is, and always has been. Later, reflecting on this, Mrs. L. brought up a passage that had struck her from my book The Island of the Colorblind. I had described a totally congenitally colorblind friend who had said, "As a kid, I used to think it would be nice to see colors. I suppose it might open up a new world, as if one were tone-deaf and suddenly become able to hear melodies. It would probably be a very interesting thing, but it would be confusing." Mrs. L. was intrigued by this and said, "If I were to hear melodies by some miracle, would I also be confused? Would I have to learn what melody is first? How would I know what I was hearing?" In 1990, Isabelle Peretz and her colleagues in Montreal devised a special battery of tests for evaluating amusia, and they have been able, in many cases, to identify the broad neural correlates of certain types of amusia. They feel that there are two basic categories of musical perception, one involving the recognition of melodies, the other the perception of rhythm or time intervals. Impairments of melody usually go with right hemisphere lesions, but representation of rhythm is much more widespread and robust, and involves not only the left hemisphere, but many subcortical systems in the basal ganglia, the cerebellum, and other areas. There are many further distinctions. Thus, some individuals can appreciate rhythm but not meter, and others have the reverse problem. There are yet other forms of amusia, all probably with their own specific neural bases. There may be an impairment of the ability to perceive dissonance, the discordant sound produced by a major second, for example, something that is normally recognized and reacted to even by infants. Gosselin Sampson and others in Peretz's lab have reported that loss of this ability, and nothing else, may occur with particular types of neurological lesion. They tested a number of subjects in discriminating dissonant from non-dissonant music, and found that only those with extensive damage to an area involved in emotional judgments, the parahippocampal cortex, were affected. Such subjects were able to judge consonant music to be pleasant, and to judge music as happy or sad, but they did not show the normal response to dissonant music, which they rated as slightly pleasant. In a quite different category, for it has nothing to do with the cognitive aspects of appreciating music, there can be a partial or total loss of the feeling or emotions normally evoked by music, even though perception of music is unimpaired. This too has its own specific neural basis and is discussed further in Chapter 24, Seduction and Indifference. In most cases, an inability to hear melodies is the consequence of very poor pitch discrimination and a distorted perception of musical tones. But some people may lose the ability to recognize melodies, even though they can hear and discriminate the component tones perfectly. This is a higher-order problem, a tune deafness or amelodia, analogous to the losing of sentence structure or meaning, perhaps, though words themselves are intact. Such a person hears a sequence of notes, but the sequence seems arbitrary, seems to have no logic or purpose, makes no musical sense. What such amusic seemed to be lacking, wrote Ayotte et al., is the knowledge and procedures required for mapping pitches and musical scales. In a recent letter, my friend Lawrence Weschler wrote, "I have an excellent sense of rhythm, and yet I am almost completely amusical in another sense. The missing element for me is the ability to hear the relations between notes, and hence, orally, to appreciate their interactions and interweavings. If you were to play two relatively close notes on the piano, say, within an octave, I would likely not be able to tell you whether one was higher than the other, whether, say, in any given sequence of notes you had gone up and up and then down and down and then up, or the reverse. Curiously, I have a relatively good sense of melody, or rather, melodic memory, in that I can, tape recorder-like, hum back a tune or even take to whistling or humming it with relative fidelity, days or weeks after being exposed to it. But I couldn't even tell you in my own humming if a particular melodic trill were going up or down. I have always been this way." Some years ago, my colleague Stephen Sparr told me of a patient of his, Professor B., a greatly gifted musician, who had played double bass with the New York Philharmonic under Toscanini, was the author of a major textbook in musical appreciation, and a close friend of Arnold Schoenberg's. "Now, at 91, Sparr wrote, "Professor B., still articulate, vibrant, and very much intellectually alive, had had a stroke that left him suddenly unable to discern a tune as simple as Happy Birthday. His perception of pitch and rhythm was perfectly intact. It was only their synthesis into melody that was gone. Yet Professor B. was admitted to the hospital with weakness of the left side, and on the day of admission had hallucinations of a choir singing. He was unable to identify Handel's Messiah, played to him on the bedside music channel, or Happy Birthday, hummed to him by Dr. Sparr. Professor B. did not recognize either piece of music, but he did not acknowledge any problem, maintaining that his difficulties were due to poor fidelity of the recording equipment, and that Dr. Sparr's humming was mere pseudo-vocalization. Professor B. could immediately get a melody by reading its notation. His musical imagery was intact, and he could hum a melody himself quite accurately. His problem was wholly one of auditory processing, an inability to hold an auditory sequence of notes in memory. While there have been many accounts of such melody deafness coming on after a head injury or stroke, I had not heard of a harmony deafness until I met Rachel Y. Rachel Y. was a gifted composer and performer in her early 40s when she came to see me a few years ago. She had been a passenger in a car that had skidded off the road and into a tree. She suffered severe head and spine injuries and was paralyzed in her legs and right arm. She lay in a coma for some days, followed by a twilight state for several weeks, before finally emerging into consciousness. She then discovered that, though her intelligence and powers of language were intact, something extraordinary had happened to her perception of music, and she described this in a letter. "There is before the accident, and there is after the accident. So many things changed. So many things are different. Some changes are easier to take than others. The most difficult one is the enormous change in my musical abilities and in the perception of music. I cannot remember all my musical abilities, but I do remember the fluency and easiness, the no-effort feeling in anything I tried to do musically. Listening to music was a complex process of quick analysis of form, harmony, melody, key, historical period, instrumentation. Listening was linear and horizontal at the same time. It was all at the tip of my fingers, at the tip of my ears. And then came the blow to my head that changed everything. Perfect pitch disappeared. I still hear and differentiate pitches, but am no longer able to recognize them with name and place in the musical space. I do hear, but in a way I hear too much. I absorb everything equally to a degree that becomes at times a real torture. How does one listen with no filtering system? Symbolically, the first piece I desperately wanted to listen to after I regained enough discernment was Beethoven's Opus 131, a four-voice, complicated string quartet that is very emotional and abstract. It is not an easy piece either to listen to or to analyze. I have no idea how I even remembered that there was such a piece at a time when I hardly remembered my name. When the music arrived, I listened to the first solo phrase of the first violin again and again, not really being able to connect its two parts. When I listened to the rest of the movement, I heard four separate voices, four thin, sharp laser beams beaming to four different directions. Today, almost 8 years after the accident, I still hear the four laser beams equally, four intense voices. And when I listen to an orchestra, I hear 20 intense laser voices. It is extremely difficult to integrate all these different voices into some entity that makes sense. In his letter referring her to me, Rachel's physician described her agonizing experience of hearing all music as discrete contrapuntal lines, being unable to hold on to the harmonic sense of chordal passages. Thus, where listening was linear, vertical, and horizontal at the same time, now it was horizontal only. Her major complaint, when she first came to see me, was of this disharmonia, her inability to integrate different voices and instruments. But she had other problems too. The injury had rendered her deaf in the right ear. She did not realize this at first, but wondered later whether it played a part in her altered perceptions of music. And though she noted the disappearance of absolute pitch right away, she was even more disabled by the undermining of her sense of relative pitch, her representation of tonal space. Now she had to rely on literal inaction. I can remember a pitch only because I remember how it feels to sing it. Just start the process of singing, and there it is. This reminded me of John Hull, a man whose book, Touching the Rock, describes how he lost his sight during middle age, and with it his once vivid visual imagery. He could no longer visualize the numeral three unless he traced it in the air with a finger. He had to make use of an inactive or procedural memory in place of the iconic one he had lost. Rachel found that if she had a score in front of her, it could at least provide a visual and conceptual representation of harmony, though this could not by itself supply the missing perception any more than a menu can provide a meal, she said. But it served to frame a piece to prevent the music from spreading all over the place. Playing the piano, and not just listening, she discovered, would also help to integrate musical information, demands both a tactile and an intellectual understanding, contributes to the ability of quickly switching attention between the different musical elements, and thereby helped integrate them into a musical piece. But this formal integration, as she called it, was still very limited. There are many levels in the brain at which perceptions of music are integrated, and many levels, therefore, at which integration may fail or be compromised. In addition to her difficulties with musical integration, Rachel experienced a similar problem with other sounds to some extent. Her auditory environment was split sometimes into discrete and unconnected elements. Street sounds, domestic sounds, or the sounds of animals, for example, might suddenly stand out and preempt her attention because they were isolated, not integrated into the normal auditory background or landscape. Neurologists refer to this as simultagnosia, and it is more often visual than auditory. For Rachel, this simultagnosia meant that she had to build up a picture of her auditory environment in a much more conscious and deliberate item-by-item way than the rest of us do. And yet, paradoxically, this had some advantages, as it forced her to experience previously overlooked sounds with a supernormal attention and intensity. Playing the piano had been impossible in the months following her injury, when her right hand was still almost paralyzed. But she taught herself in these months to use her left hand for writing and all else. Remarkably, she also took up painting at this time, using her left hand. "I never painted before the accident," she told me. "When I was still wheelchair-bound and my right hand was in a splint, I taught myself to write with my left hand, to make needlepoint works. It was not an option to let injury dictate my life. I was dying to play, make music. I bought a piano and got the shock of my life. Yet the burning creative urge did not stop, and I turned to painting. I had to open the color tubes with my teeth and left hand, and my very first painting ever, a 24-by-36-inch canvas, was painted only with the left hand. With time and physical therapy, her right hand became stronger, and Rachel found herself slowly able to play the piano again with both hands. When I visited her a few months after our initial meeting, I found her working on a Beethoven bagatelle, a Mozart sonata, Schumann's forest scenes, a Bach three-part invention, and Dvorak's Slavonic dances for four hands. This last she would play with her piano teacher, whom she visited weekly. Rachel told me that she had experienced a distinct improvement in her powers to integrate the horizontals of music. She had recently been to a performance of three short Monteverdi operas. At first, she said, she delighted in the music, experiencing it for the first time since her accident as harmony, as integration. After a few minutes, however, it became difficult. It was a great cognitive effort to hold the strands together. And then the music burst apart, becoming a chaos of different voices. At the beginning, I enjoyed it very much, but then I was caught up in a fragmented music environment. It became a challenge, and gradually a torture. And Monteverdi is a good example, because he is so contrapuntally complicated, but at the same time uses a very small orchestra, with no more than three vocal parts at the same time. I was reminded here of my patient Virgil, who had been virtually blind all his life, and then at the age of 50 had gained sight following eye surgery. Virgil is described in To See and Not See, in An Anthropologist on Mars. But his new sight was very limited and fragile, in large part because, with very limited early vision, his brain had never developed robust visual cognitive systems. So vision was taxing for him, and when he shaved, for example, he could see and recognize his face in the mirror at first, but after a few minutes he would have to struggle to hold on to a recognizable visual world. Finally, he would give up and shave by touch, because the visual image of his face had decomposed into unrecognizable fragments. Rachel had, in fact, also developed some visual problems following the accident, peculiar problems of visual synthesis, though with typical resourcefulness, she had managed to turn these to creative use. She had, to some degree, a difficulty in synthesizing the elements of an entire scene at a glance, a visual simultagnosia analogous to her auditory one. Thus she would notice one thing, then another, then a third. Her attention would be commandeered successively by different elements, and she could piece the scene together as a whole only slowly and with difficulty, in an intellectual rather than a perceptual way. Her paintings and collages made use of this weakness, and, indeed, turned it into a strength, disassembling the visual world and reassembling it in new ways. Though her apartment is now hung with her many paintings and collages, Rachel has not been able to write music since her accident in 1993. The chief reason for this is another sort of amusia, a lack of musical imagery. Before the accident, she used to compose in her head without a piano, straight onto manuscript paper. But now, she says, she cannot hear what she is writing. She once had the most vivid musical imagery, and as soon as she looked at a score, her own or another composer's, she could hear the music in her mind with full orchestral or choral complexity. This musical imagery has been virtually extinguished by her injury, and that makes it difficult for her to transcribe what she has just improvised, for as soon as she reaches for her manuscript paper, in the seconds it takes her to put pen in hand, the music she has just played evaporates from her mind. With the difficulty in imagery comes a difficulty in working memory, and this makes it impossible for her to retain what she has just composed. "This is the major loss," she told me. "I need a mediator between me and the printed page." A crucial breakthrough thus came for her in 2006, when she found a young collaborator and learned with him to use a music processing computer. The computer can hold in its memory what she cannot hold in her own, and Rachel can now explore the themes that she has created on the piano and transform them into notation or into the voices of different instruments. She can achieve a continuity with her own compositions and orchestrate or develop them with the help of her collaborator and her computer. Rachel has now embarked on her first large-scale composition since her accident 13 years ago. She has decided to take a string quartet, one of the last works she wrote before her accident, to disassemble it and reassemble it in a new way, as she says, to cut it into the wind, collect the parts, and put it together in a new form. She wants to incorporate the ambient sounds, which she is now so conscious of, to weave sounds together that are not meant to be musical, to compose a new sort of music. Against the background of this, she herself will improvise by breathing, singing, and playing a variety of instruments. Her work table, when I visited her, contained an alto recorder, a Chinese jade flute, a Syrian flute, plumber's brass tubing, bells and drums, and an assortment of wooden rhythm instruments. The sound, the music, will be interwoven with projections of visual forms and patterns provided by photographs she has taken. She played for me, on her computer, a small sample of the finished piece, which starts with breathing, a darkness. Though she agrees with Stravinsky that music does not represent anything but itself, when she composed this opening, her mind was full of the idea of coma and near death, a time when, for days, the sound of her own breathing, amplified by a respirator, was almost the only sound she heard. This opening passage is followed by incoherent fragments, a shattered world, as she puts it, representing her own broken awareness at a time when nothing made sense. There are agitated, strongly rhythmic pizzicatos at this point, and unexpected sounds of all sorts. Then comes a strongly melodic passage, her recomposing a world, and finally, darkness and breathing again. But a free breathing, she says, representing reconciliation, acceptance. Rachel thinks of this new piece, to some extent, as autobiographic, a rediscovery of identity. And when it is performed next month, it will be her coming out, her first return to the world of musical composition and performance, the public world, in 13 years. Chapter 9. Papa blows his nose in G. Absolute pitch. People with absolute pitch can immediately, unthinkingly tell the pitch of any note without either reflection or comparison with an external standard. They can do this not only with any note they hear, but with any note they imagine or hear in their heads. Indeed, Gordon B., a professional violinist who wrote to me about tinnitus, or ringing in his ears, remarked, matter-of-factly, that his tinnitus was a high F natural. He did not realize, I think, that saying this was in any way unusual, but of the millions of people with tinnitus, probably not one in 10,000 could say what pitch their tinnitus has. The precision of absolute pitch varies, but it is estimated that most people with it can identify upwards of 70 tones in the middle region of the auditory range, and each of these 70 tones has, for them, a unique and characteristic quality that distinguishes it absolutely from any other note. The Oxford Companion to Music was a sort of Arabian Nights for me as a boy, an inexhaustible source of musical stories, and it gives many charming examples of absolute pitch. Sir Frederick Owsley, a former professor of music at Oxford, for example, was all his life remarkable for his sense of absolute pitch. At 5, he was able to remark, "Only think, Papa blows his nose in G." He would say that it thundered in G, or that the wind was whistling in D, or that the clock, with a 2-note chime, struck in B minor, and when the assertion was tested, it would invariably be found correct. For most of us, such an ability to recognize an exact pitch seems uncanny, almost like another sense, a sense we can never hope to possess, such as infrared or X-ray vision. But for those who are born with absolute pitch, it seems perfectly normal. The Finnish entomologist Olavi Sotavalta, an expert on the sounds of insects in flight, was greatly assisted in his studies by having absolute pitch, for the sound pitch of an insect in flight is produced by the frequency of its wing beats. Not content with musical notation, Sotavalta was able to estimate very exact frequencies by ear. The sound pitch made by the moth Plusia gamma approximates a low F sharp, but Sotavalta could estimate it more precisely as having a frequency of 46 cycles per second. Such an ability, of course, requires not only a remarkable ear, but a knowledge of the scales and frequencies with which pitch can be correlated. Yet such a correlation, though immensely impressive, deflects attention from the real wonder of absolute pitch. To those with absolute pitch, every tone, every key seems qualitatively different, each possessing its own flavor or feel, its own character. Those who have absolute pitch often compare it to color. They hear G sharpness as instantly and automatically as we see blue. Indeed, the word chroma is sometimes used in musical theory. While absolute pitch may sound like a delicious extra sense, allowing one to instantly sing or notate any music at its correct pitch, it may cause problems too. One such problem occurs with the inconstant tuning of musical instruments. Thus, the 7-year-old Mozart, comparing his own little violin to that of his friend Schachner, said, "If you have not altered the tuning of your violin since I last played on it, it is half a quarter of a tone flatter than mine here." So it is related in the Oxford Companion to Music. There are many tales about Mozart's ear, some, no doubt, apocryphal. When the composer Michael Torkey encountered my own ancient piano, which, still having its original 19th-century strings, is not tuned up to the 440 cycles per second standard of modern pianos, he instantly remarked that it was a third of a tone flat. Such an overall sharpness or flatness would not be noticed by someone without absolute pitch, but it can be distressing and even disabling to those who do have it. The Oxford Companion to Music again gives many examples, including one of an eminent pianist who, playing the Moonlight Sonata, a piece which every schoolgirl plays, got through it only with the greatest difficulty, because the piano was tuned to a pitch he was not accustomed to, and he experienced the distress of playing the piece in one key and hearing it in another. When people with absolute pitch hear a familiar piece of music played in the wrong key, Daniel Levitin and Susan Rogers write, they often become agitated or disturbed. To get a sense of what it is like, imagine going to the produce market and finding that, because of a temporary disorder of visual processing, the bananas all appear orange, the lettuce yellow, and the apples purple. Transposing music from one key to another is something which any competent musician can do easily and almost automatically. But for someone with absolute pitch, each key has its own unique character, and the key in which one has always heard a piece is likely to be felt as the only right one. Transposing a piece of music for someone with absolute pitch can be analogous to painting a picture with all the wrong colors. Another difficulty was mentioned to me by the neurologist and musician Stephen Frucht, who himself has absolute pitch. He sometimes experiences a certain difficulty in hearing intervals or harmonies because he is so conscious of the chroma of the notes that compose them,